Greetings, everybody. This is Tabitha back for, pardon me, another edition of White Wellness. Today is February 12th, 2021, broadcasting out of New York for the American National Radio Network. And that song right there was Stevie Ray Vaughan in Double Trouble with Love Struck Baby way back in 1990. And I played that song because this is a Valentine's Day show. I did one last year and I'm doing one this year, albeit a very different one. Last year, I talked more about the traditional aspects of what originally was known as something Lupercalia, I forget, something like that. That's the original thing which ended up becoming what is known as Valentine's Day. Today, I think it is Lupercalia. That is it. Yes, this is an ancient, possibly pre-Roman pastoral annual festival observed from 13th to 15th century, let's see, evil spirits purify the city. I think this has to do with it. Yeah, it does. February 13th to February 15th. So this is originally what Valentine's Day was. And last year we talked about that. So on this year's Valentine's Day special, I wanted to talk more about just kind of different stuff. Chocolate, foods that one could eat around this time of the year, zodiac signs and how that works in with Valentine's Day. And I think it's important to focus also on not just the romantic aspect of Valentine's Day, but just having love for yourself or your family or your race or any of these things. I see the Oive media promoting a lot of like people loving like their pets, which of course is good, but they're making it into something ridiculous like they always do. And they're also showing this thing, they're calling it Galentine's Day, which is like two women together celebrating it. So there's that kind of homosexual overtone. And of course, a lot of these adverts now are showing same-sex couples celebrating this stuff or the race-mixing stuff. I keep on getting all these emails where the people that they're using in the stock photos, everything is mixed. There's so much of this going on these days, it's hard to even navigate around it. I just press delete or unsubscribe a lot. So this show, getting back to that, is going to be all about all this stuff, more like the mainstream aspects of Valentine's Day. But of course, this is White Wellness, so it will be going through the racial lens. But before we talk about that, I wanted to talk a little bit about this interesting email I got about someone who's in the know, like we are over here at the network, in regards to what's going on in the world. This person doesn't mention the Oives or the Skeksis, but still just gives an interesting perspective of what it's like to be someone who doesn't have the wool pulled over their eyes and can see what's going on. Kind of like a living outside of the matrix, if you want to make a Oive transsexual reference, but just living outside of like the Zog shitstem, I think is a better way for saying it. So here's this little piece about kind of looking in with all the insanity going on, but knowing from the outside. It's interesting to watch the world go insane. People and promise to, quote, make them safer. Sadly, this dysfunction is not new. Its real cause has been there for quite some time. It's just that these days we all get to see it on the outside instead of being more invisible on the inside. The system trains you to react, to engage with it. So there we have like a feeding, right? It makes you think that doing something about it means feeding your energy into the very thing you want to see disappear. Do you want to feed that thought as its sustenance? Do you want to contribute to it living longer? If not, consider withdrawing your energy completely and directing it towards the creation of the life you choose to live. The system, or the shitstem, has brainwashed, brain-poisoned generations of children into thinking that changing the world is a pursuit worthy of a life. What if it isn't? Even more than that, what if that dream is simply a diversion? A distraction to make sure no one ever discovers that the true weakness of the Matrix or the Zog shitstem is the requirement of human life force to exist. You don't need to, quote, change the world, for the current world system is beyond all chance of redemption. The work is to create a new world, one that you actually want to live in. Without your support, the Matrix or the Zog shitstem will starve and dissolve into nothing. So without your support, no longer supporting it, supporting white businesses, you know, doing things more on that vein. So I thought that was a very worthwhile email right there. And I kind of feel the same way, kind of knowing what's going on and looking at people run towards their slavery. It's kind of wild to have a seat over here in this part of everything, but what a great seat to have, right? So very interesting stuff right there, a nice introduction for the show. And now I want to talk a little bit about this thing that they have in Denmark, this thing they called hygge. It's like this art of coziness. And since it is the winter season, and it's very wintry where I am here in New York, we have a lot of snow. It's been real cold. I really like it though. I feel like now, since I eat more of a natural human diet, I have more of this temperance for the cold, so it feels good to be outside. I'm no longer really cold from it, so that's a nice thing, as opposed to always feeling cold all the time. That's kind of a yuck feeling right there. So I want to talk a little bit about this Danish thing that they have called hygge, which is this art of just like cozy living. Maybe you've heard about it before. It's been out there in the ethers for a little bit of time. So I was reading this magazine, it kind of had a little piece on it, so it made me kind of want to talk about it a little bit more on the broadcast, because it is something that is white, definitely. And we all like to kind of create that coziness in our homes at this time of year, you know, snuggling up with a good book, a cup of tea, perhaps a cat or a dog or a child next to you. So this is all really good stuff and really white stuff. So what is hygge? Everything you need to know about the Danish lifestyle trend. And of course, who cares if something's trendy? This is white and classic. That's why we should, I guess, adhere to it or at least acknowledge it. In the last couple of years, and particularly in the winter months, we're sure you've come across a certain word, hygge. But what in the world does hygge mean exactly? It's the Danish concept that cannot be translated into one word, but it encompasses a feeling of cozy contentment and well-being through enjoying the simple things in life. If you've ever enjoyed reading a book indoors on a rainy Sunday with a cup of hot cocoa on a snow day, you have experienced hygge without even knowing it. It's like that cozy feel, like when you have the fireplace on, if you have a fireplace, or maybe there's some soup or some broth simmering on the stove. It's that feeling of like creating that energy, that aura in your house. And they've taken a lot of that away from people when you think about it, with the whole thing, the whole Zog thing of everyone working all the time, everyone like running after a carrot and a stick and never getting to enjoy the stuff that they actually work to afford. So it is nice to kind of see how we can reflect and do this type of stuff and make our home a sanctuary. And I've noticed a lot of people have gone mad since Oyed AI because their house really wasn't like a hygge sanctuary before that. They just basically, it was a place that they probably just, I don't know, slept in maybe. But when you have that coziness and you have hobbies and things to do, like I can't imagine anyone ever being bored. I just find that to be a mind-boggling concept. I think that's like a boring thing. Like if you're bored, you're boring. I just don't get that. There's so many things to do, but we should always embrace this cozy feeling to make it feel more appetizing for us, so we'll want to do more things. The national obsession with all things cozy is credited as one of the reasons Denmark is always at the top of the list for the world's happiest countries, despite their infamously miserable weather, winters. And recently, the rest of the world has begun to catch on to this wonderful way of life. So pretty cool. It's actually also similar to something that the Germans have called Gemütlichkeit. And it's the Dutch idea of Gezelligheid, which is warm and cozy lifestyle. So that's what, basically the same thing. It's been part of the Danish culture since about the 1800s, when the word first appeared in the written language, the word hygge, and it's derived from a Norwegian word for well-being, kind of like almost like eugenics, right? It's used as both a noun and an adjective, but it's more of a way of life. And of course, this now has become a trendy thing, but this, I guess this is something that basically some people could kind of overmesh with the Oyed AI lifestyle, but maybe not in the traditional hygge sense. But basically, you guys get the gist of what it is. It's just enjoying time. Like, you know, it's also, it's reality too. It's not being hoovered and swooped into the, you know, the Jews feed or the anti-social media and, you know, feeding that Bolshevik beast. Like, it's just you relaxing, feeling cozy, having, you know, maybe a cup of tea or reading something and just disconnecting from all of that non-reality. This is actually reality. And in a way, when you think about it, when you do stuff like that, that's actually real stuff, tangible stuff, the stuff we all kind of grew up on and did maybe 10 years ago more so, or 15, 20 years ago more so, we can get that back even in this modern world. But stuff like that, that's based in reality, will be recharging you and you'll feel refreshed after doing something like that. You might even fall asleep because you feel just so relaxed. But when you do all this stuff like the anti-social media and the Jews feed and all that type of stuff, that's such a drain. Yeah, it's something that jolts people into like a dopamine fix or a dopamine high, but it's just like it's an energy drain when you think about it. And plus, of course, they're feeding on you too. Like that first thing I read about the Matrix feeding on, you know, the system, the shitstem. The shitstem needs your support, right? For it to feed, it needs its currency. So maybe doing this hygge stuff and just giving the finger to all of that stuff, maybe, I don't know, the future wave, who knows? It could be like a trend, setting up more of like a white nationalist trend or a racialist trend, this hygge stuff, who knows? So other things you can add if you wanted to practice this hygge stuff is candles in the house. Of course, always be careful with those, especially if there's small pets in the house, like a kitten that could knock it over. Fireplaces, throw blankets, homemade comfort foods, like, you know, homemade beverages, hot cocoa and stuff like that. also things that would be appropriate to kind of like a hygge type of dinner if you wanted to host one. Could mean like pastries and meatballs with a lot of coffee, as well as chicken pot pie and chocolate cake, according to this article right here. And what isn't hygge? So the stuff that isn't hygge, I thought it was interesting. It's kind of like what they were promoting kind of during like Oyed AI for people to do. Staying on the phone all day or, you know, on your computer all day, that wouldn't be hygge. Hibernating indoors alone all winter, like just like, you know, basically not seeing anyone, not doing anything. Purchasing products just to be on trend. I mean, this is probably what most people were doing during Oyed AI, right? This type of stuff. So this is not hygge. Hygge is not lounging in the house and eating KFC and all that type of stuff, playing video games. That's not hygge. Hygge is enjoying the natural white environment, not doing those Talmudic trinket type of things. So interesting article right there about hygge. Very cool. Let's take a Gandhi at the chat right here. Okay. Let's see. We have some people joining us. Oh, hello, everyone. I'm doing well. I'm glad that everyone has joined us thus far on this Friday for the broadcast. So yeah, this hygge stuff seems kind of cool. I mean, I've probably done some of this stuff in my life, and I'm sure you probably have too, not even knowing it was really this hygge stuff. But this does really seem to be more of like a white trend. Like I've noticed, I guess, with all the races I've known throughout my life, it's usually whites that usually have this like more like cozy gear, you know, for this time of year. And of course, we're the ones that originated, and not maybe originated, but historically have lived in the colder areas, right? If anyone's going to be able to survive the cold, if this really is a global cooling thing going on, well, it's going to be whites. So yeah, a little bit about hygge right there. Pretty cute stuff. A nice thing to add to your repertoire, your winter repertoire. You could probably even do like a summer style of hygge where you're just relaxing in the house in one way, shape, or form. So there's always that as well. And oh yeah, speaking of hygge and everything and Valentine's Day, I am having my own little cooking club meeting that I had one last month, and I think I had talked about on a roundtable with Mike at one point, but I'm having a second installation of this little cooking club that I started. And what a great thing to have, a club just to hang out with other members of our race and just to talk about stuff and cook, and that's pretty much what we do in this club. So that's a great way to talk to people and to spread information, is to just start yourself a little club. And you don't even have to tell anyone who's joining that it's a pro-white or it's a whites club, whatever. You can just be yourself about it. You don't even have to put yourself in that group. Just, you know, ask people to come to any type of club or join together who you want to spend time with, essentially. This will be the second installment of this event at my house. Very cool. And we have more people actually wanting to come this time, which is even nicer. It was such a hit last time. And this time we're doing a special V-Day edition. So all weekend long, I'll be in the V-Day spirit with the broadcast and also having this cooking class. And we're making some pretty interesting things. We aim to cook like metabolic style food and talk about health and talk about Zog or honestly, whatever else comes up. It's pretty cool. So we're having some very interesting recipes for this class. We're having a flourless chocolate cake. And I'm making like these marshmallows. I've actually never made marshmallows before. I'm making like swirled pink marshmallows and coconut cookies. So pretty cool stuff. Great way to get together with other people is to cook with them. Great icebreaker as well. And great way to just, I guess, know people. Yeah, great stuff. I mean, I think it's nice to have all the stuff we have online with, you know, the broadcasts and other types of anti-social medias if we can tolerate it. But it's also nice to have that connection face-to-face, especially in this world that's becoming ever increasingly transhumanistic by the day. It's crazy. I mean, even this JWO chattel feedback, that makes people look alien. You know, it really does. Especially like I was thinking earlier before, like if someone doesn't have their hair and they're wearing the chattel feedback, they definitely look like very much more alien than someone who isn't doing that or was only doing one of those things. So I was thinking like they've probably been trying to do stuff for years, and like I know they have, that has damaged, you know, the thyroid of people and damaged people's organs. Then they'll have problems like with their hair, and then like they'll lose their hair and they'll look more alien. And like, you know, when they do the chemotherapy, that makes you lose your hair and then you look more alien. It's crazy. Like when you think about it and just like look back, they've probably created all these types of things just to make people look more alien, to like accept this agenda, to like lose their humanness. I know it's far out, but hey, it sounds plausible to me. So yeah, starting a group, starting a club, what a great thing to do. What a great way to just connect with other people. This is a time for connection. When the Oy Vey system or shitstem is promoting all this disconnect and connecting online, which of course has its time and place, we should be focusing more on connecting in real life. I think it's pretty important. And people will listen to what you have to say if you say it in an appetizing way. They will. All right, on to some more V-Day flavored type of information. I wanted to mention a little bit about Cupid, the story of Cupid, that very cute little cherubic looking character. Let me just take a sip of liquid. So the story of Cupid. What would Valentine's Day be without images of a golden-tressed boy? Armed with bow and arrows, the arrows represent feelings of love and desire. And they are aimed and cast at various individuals, causing them to fall deeply in love or to fall out of it. In Roman mythology, the boy is known as Cupid and is the son of Venus, the goddess of love. Portrayed as a cherubic and mischievous toddler, this magical boy was purported to be the matchmaker of the gods and mortals alike. For students of Greek mythology, Cupid represents Eros, the Greek word for desire. He was the son of Aphrodite, Venus's Hellenistic counterpart, and would play the hearts of mortals and gods, sometimes leaving mayhem in his wake. In Greek mythology, Eros was more of a teenager than a bubbly boy, and capitalized on his status as a heartthrob rather than a cherubic status of the Roman mythology. According to Richard Martin, a Stanford University professor, while Cupid may have been an adorable imp, some historians say Eros had a darker side, going so far as to describe him as a calculating and sinister individual, forcing the wrong people into lovelorn matches. According to Museum Hack, whilst Cupid could make people fall in and out of love, he also was once in love himself. In this telling, Cupid is a young man when Venus learns that a mortal girl is born with such great beauty that others start to forget the worship of Venus, adoring this girl instead. Upset about the misdirected adoration towards the mortal, Venus asks Cupid to have the girl Psyche fall in love with a monster. Cupid agrees, but once he sees Psyche, he, quote, accidentally hits himself with one of his own golden arrows and falls in love with Psyche. The resulting match does not prove easy, though a series of unfortunate events, Psyche must prove her love to Cupid to accomplish various tasks to win back his heart. Eventually, Psyche does and achieves goddess status. Cupid has been portrayed both as a young man and a child through the Renaissance art and beyond. When Valentine's Day became popular in the 18th and 19th centuries, Cupid was linked to Valentine's Day celebrations due to his matchmaking abilities. His popularity only continued in the early 20th century when Hallmark began to manufacture Valentine's Day cards featuring Cupid. So he's pretty much an early fixture when you think about it, I guess like in the card industry, but only really for the last 100 years or so in the whole scheme of things. Cupid helped push together the ancient mythology, and he can even be the catalyst today for modern matchmaking as well. So that was that little article. This is just from like one of the papers that comes to the house. Occasionally there's something in there that's remotely worth for the show. So, you know, I find things for the show everywhere, but interesting right there how it all goes down. I always kind of saw Cupid more as like a cute little cherub than more of like a teen, but I guess it all has different stories right there. And who even knows if some of this stuff about him having a dark, sinister side, like the Eros character, who knows if that's just like some Oy Vey inversion or insertion, rather. Sometimes we just don't know. I'm not a Greek mythology expert. I did take, I think, a class, at least one class when I was at university. Pretty good class. It was enjoyable, but yeah, just something there, a little festive stuff for the holiday. All right, so now a couple of more things that I have that I wanted to talk about. Oh, a little bit about chocolate, actually. Yeah, this is pretty groovy. Something that's usually associated with Valentine's Day is chocolate, although it's also associated with other types of holidays as well. So wanted to say a little bit about chocolate and a little bit about the history of chocolate, too. I've gone through phases in my life where sometimes I like it, sometimes I don't like it. Now I'm in a phase where I do like it. And chocolate is a good source of magnesium. So if you ever feel like you're just craving chocolate out of the blue, you could just be magnesium deficient. In fact, most people are in general, but sometimes when ladies are like, they have to have chocolate around menstrual time, that usually is a magnesium type of a thing. So here's a bit about being sweet on chocolate. Once treasured as a gift from the gods, this treat can be used in baking and add depth and flavor to savory dishes. So this is the month to celebrate all things chocolate. And when I think of February, I think of Valentine's Day. I also think of the people's birthdays, I guess, in February. I also think about sometimes that it's going to be a leap year, like last year was a leap year. But I really don't think about the President's Day, and I certainly don't think about Black History Month. And has anyone else noticed that everywhere you go, they're promoting Black History Month? Like even the sidebar of like YouTube says BHM or something like that at the top. And first I was like, what is that BHM? What the hell is that? Is that like a new type of BLM? And I was like, oh, that's what it is. Okay. But yeah, it's like everywhere. Like I got some email from Shutterstock, which is like some image company yesterday about changing my password. Like, I don't even think I have an account with them. But anyway, as soon as I click on the website, it's like, celebrate Black History Month. It's like everyone is celebrating it. It's mind-boggling. Anyway, it's a waste of time to even talk about it, because like, why waste my breath when I could talk about chocolate and stuff that actually matters? Our love affair with this sweet treat goes back centuries. Chocolate, not Black History Month. Archaeologists have found evidence that chocolate was produced by ancient civilizations in the jungles of Mexico and Central America 4,000 years ago. And of course, our people have been to every continent on the planet, so we definitely have been there. So we probably have more of a connection with chocolate than we think we do, because we usually just think about it from it being like a Mongoloid food from that area of the world. The bitter cacao bean, believed to be a gift from the gods, was roasted, part of the process that turns it into cocoa, and ground into a paste before being mixed with water. The Spanish conquests of Central America introduced, so they got to add that in, introduced chocolate to Europe, where it became the drink of kings and aristocrats. It wasn't until the 19th century that chocolate became mass-produced into bars and chunks. Today, on average, Americans consume nearly 11 pounds annually in a variety of forms. And yeah, LOL, chocolate lives matter. That's funny in like kind of like a double way, right? Moderate amounts of chocolate may even be good for you. Cacao beans are a source of flavonoids, which have antioxidant properties and may play a role in reducing the risk of heart disease. The darker the chocolate, the more flavonoids it contains. But experts also suggest it doesn't take much. A square or two of dark chocolate is enough to yield the potential benefits. And of course, it does have caffeine in it. So for some people, it may be something that you don't want to have later in the day if you're a slow metabolizer of caffeine. So think about that if you're going to add chocolate to your repertoire. Some people can eat chocolate before bed and have it with their warm milk and everything is cream cheese. But if you can't, have it earlier in the day. In its purest form, chocolate is unsweetened. Pure cocoa powder is a result of cocoa solids that are pulverized after the cocoa butter is extracted. So then it becomes two different parts. That's why when you're going to make chocolate, you usually need cocoa powder, cocoa butter, or you know, bars of like raw pieces of cacao, but they're all typically taken and separated. Baking or unsweetened chocolate is a mix of cocoa solids and cocoa butter without any added sugar. Bittersweet chocolate, used primarily for cooking and baking, is a blend of chocolate liquor as well as cocoa butter, sugar, and vanilla. And they have semi-sweet, which has more sugar, and milk chocolate, which also contains milk solids, the lighter color. And then, of course, there's always white chocolate too, or white power chocolate, as I like to refer to it. But that doesn't really have any of the antioxidant benefits because, well, it doesn't have any of the cocoa powder, just the cacao bean. Chocolate is surprisingly, hold on, I missed a paragraph. Though most people think of chocolate as a sweet or baking treat, it can be given depth and richness to savory dishes. Powdered chocolate can also be used as a meat rub. And dark chocolate can be added fullness to a sauce or a stew. Some dishes such as a chicken mole or even chocolate can be used as an enhancer. I've actually tried that before too, just like you can use coffee in certain savory recipes. Chocolate is surprisingly delicate and doesn't like sudden temperature changes. Store in a cool, dry place, but never in the fridge. In my house, chocolate doesn't last that long, so storage isn't a worry. just a little bit there about chocolate, which sometimes gets a foul rap from some people, and some people it gets different. So it depends who you talk to, what they're going to say, if it's good or if it's not. I think it depends on the person. I think everything is pretty individual when it comes to health. Certain things I think you can say across the board are not good for us to eat as humans, but it's all individual what works for certain people, and that should really matter than people getting caught up in the mix of any of these, you know, YouTube dietary politics. That just seems kind of like a waste, essentially. So now I wanted to talk a little bit more about the foods that would be good for Valentine's Day and why certain foods are aphrodisiacs. And that's a food that I guess would be a food that would, you know, create feelings of romance or love, like the god Aphrodite or the goddess Aphrodite. And there are many foods which are the opposite of aphrodisiac. I mean, a lot of most people's diets are probably composed of these foods. And you know what? It's all the foods that JWO promotes too. It's mind-boggling. It's crazy. We can't trust any institution they have out there. I know some people just oftentimes they'll trust like one institution, but it'll be like, oh yeah, the media is a lie, but then they'll trust like allopathy. But we can't trust any of these institutions. We have to always look into them. Is there some small aspect of each and we can take something from positively? Sure, but should we trust them? No, we should always look into it. And anything that Zog promotes, we should always be leery of that and say, why are they promoting this, right? With anything, it's always worth looking into. So here's a little bit about aphrodisiacs in the context of Valentine's Day. And this comes from a book that I bought recently. I love buying like cookbooks, like wherever I go places, I like to just get as many as I can, especially these used cookbooks. Whenever you're thrift shopping, you'll be able to find cookbooks, easy way to find good cookbooks. And if you're on the prowl for cookbooks that have recipes that are more suitable to how you should eat, try to get older cookbooks. Like try to get stuff from like maybe the 60s or 70s or beyond. Those are where you'll really find more gems than the ones that are more recent where the food has really changed quite a bit. But anyway, this book has kind of like a funny name. It's called Intercourses, an Aphrodisiac Cookbook. So it's all these just fun recipes. And a lot of these are just amazing recipes for just everyday eating. But they're also recipes that would be considered aphrodisiac. So essentially, it's healthy food. That's pretty much what it is. They're just using this as a way to frame it. So onward, aphrodisiac. The word itself almost seems magical. On first glance, it conjures up images of Spanish fly, powdered rhino horn, and other strange exotic ingredients meant to wield power over unsuspecting souls. Throughout history, lovers have depended on love potions enhanced with charms of enchantment for those hearts stubborn to Cupid's arrow. Sometimes that meant a secret ingredient slipped into a goblet of wine. Over time, an elaborate concoction gulped down for stamina. The qualifying factors for aphrodisiacs were relatively simple. The rarer an ingredient, the more likely it held aphrodisiacal qualities. Likewise, the more an ingredient resembled a sexual organ, the stronger its power over the libido. The intercontinental commerce and science reared their ugly heads. With the emergence of a more global economy, tomatoes quit seeming rare, everybody had access to chocolate, and coffee became a staple of daily life. Science only heightened the situation, stripping age-old aphrodisiacs of their mysterious and powerful qualities. Spanish fly, that simply aggravates the urogenital tract, creating a burning sensation that some would associate with a heat of passion. That doesn't really sound that good. Powdered rhino horn, it comes from a phallic-shaped nutrient-packed tissue. Other than that, its power appears only psychological. Coincidentally, many foods have long considered aphrodisiacs are low in fat and high in vitamins and minerals. A diet heavy in these foods then yields a healthy body with the energy, blood flow, and nutrients needed for peak sexual experience. In providing explanations for improved sexual performance, science dispelled any connection between an ingredient's sexual appearance and its power over human sexual experience, eliminating many a classic list of the aphrodisiacs. And of course, science would do that because science is Talmudic, Judaic. It's been taken over and co-opted, well, like everything else. So what if an oyster resembles a slew of sexual organs? Science is science. Fact is fact, and everything has an explanation.
But explanation or no explanation, anyone who has ever fed a lover grapes knows that aphrodisiacs do exist. Anyone who has served an elaborate candlelit meal, painstakingly prepared with love, knows the potential power of food. We don't need scientific proof to know the aphrodisiacs exist. We need only the experience for them ourselves to know that they are in fact a very potent force at our disposal. And that's what this book is for, an experience for everyone to basically combine the magic of food and ambiance with love and sensuality. And it says going on, that's pretty much what it says right here. That was the end of that little piece right there about just about aphrodisiacs and how they, of course, like everything else, they would co-opt that. We can't be surprised. That's just the way things are at this point. Just have to filter through, use your Aryan filtration system to be able to see through things. That's what I typically do. So here's a little bit more about chocolate. We were just talking about chocolate before, but here's a little bit more in this book. The Aztecs, the Mayans, were the first to recognize the potency of chocolate, celebrating the harvest of the cacao bean with festivals of wild orgies. The Aztec ruler Montezuma reportedly drank 50 cups of chocolate each day to better serve his harem of 600 women. Yowza. The belief in chocolate carried on through a Mayan empire where payment for a night at the brothel cost one handful of cacao beans. 17th century church officials deemed it sinful to partake in chocolate. Casanova, the infamous 18th century lover, believed in the power of chocolate, and if sales are any indication of our faith in chocolate, then we do too. Sales in the 1990s averaged 600,000 tons of cacao beans consumed each year. I'm seeing a big trend with the number 6 in this article. Obviously, a tried and true staple for lovers. Chocolate now has backing from the scientific community. Besides the jolt of caffeine served up in a piece of chocolate, this savory candy also contains PEA, or phenylethylamine, the very same molecule that courses through the veins when one is in love. Combine our internal stores of this natural amphetamine with chocolate, and one only heightens that giddy sensation known as love. So a bit about chocolate. It's the first food in this book. And then another one is asparagus. And asparagus is also considered an aphrodisiac food. The one thing about asparagus that stinks, literally, is that it makes usually people's urine smell really weird. So I don't know how that could really be an aphrodisiac. But anyway, I'll read on. These stately stalks first received their aphrodisiac status from the doctrine of signatures. Also known as the law of similarities, this theory says that if one thing looks like or is reminiscent of another, then it will improve or aid that which it looks like. So if a food looks sexual, the doctrine of signatures says it is meant to improve or aid sex. And indeed, asparagus is beautiful, albeit slender, phallic symbol. The great French lovers of yesteryear dined on 3 courses of it a night before the wedding. According to Diane Ackerman in A Natural History of Love, the legendary Hollywood lover of all lovers, Richard Burton, deemed the stalks lascivious. Today we know that asparagus is packed with potassium and phosphorus, calcium, vitamin E, and offers the love-hungry extra energy, a well-working urinary tract and kidneys, and a natural dose of the sex vitamin necessary for increased hormone production. And minerals are very important in food. People oftentimes get caught up in the mix, like just obsessing over macros or obsessing over the origin of a food, if it's a plant food or an animal food. And they get so caught up in that that they don't remember that food has to be mineral rich. I mean, there's so many psyops out there right now when it comes to everything, but especially food. And that's one where there's tons of psyops. It's always divide and conquer. It's no different than the political sphere, right? So number 3 would be chilies, very much thought to be an aphrodisiac food because of the spicy factor. Long believed to house a complete arsenal of aphrodisiac powers, the chili pepper makes a strong statement to all who taste its flesh. With more than 200 varieties worldwide, chilies seem to have many options for heating things up as clever lovers do. There's the firecracker hot of the tiny red-orange piquin that explodes in the mouth with the first bite. The heated sweet of the wrinkled pepperoncini, the delayed fireball of the dark brown chilaca that lurks behind other flavors until it's ready to take charge. the gently pleasing spice of the slender green Anaheim. Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, inventor of Corn Flakes and the founder of the Kellogg Cereal Company, knew what he was talking about when he advised nymphomaniacs to stay away from peppers. Eating peppers gets the blood rushing, the heart pumping, the face flushing, and the pores sweating. All reactions strangely familiar to what one can experience with anything from a goodnight kiss at the front door to a heated quickie during the lunch hour. And that guy, Kellogg, was a total nut. He was the one who was developing that cereal, and he was, I guess, promoting the idea that, like, children should be circumcised, like, both boys and girls, and fed this, like, dull cardboard diet to, like, I guess, like, dull any sexual impulse of masturbation. Like, the guy was absolute crazy. But I guess he would know that peppers would be not a good food for a nymphomaniac because he knew about what foods would be good for a castration diet. So a bit about chilies right there. And chilies are nice sometimes. Oftentimes chilies are a nicer way to get spice than hot sauce because sometimes there'll be ingredients in the hot sauce that will be irritating and the chilies won't be as irritating. I tend to prefer the chilies, though sometimes I do use the hot sauce, but you have to really make sure you get a good one because a lot of them will have gums and stuff like that. And those things are best to stay away from, like the xanthan gum and the guar gum and that type of stuff. Those are not really things that you want to be eating. They can be bad for your gut. And really, these things aren't food. We should always think about if we're going to be eating something, putting food into our body, not putting food-like thing with chemicals. Okay, onward. That was a little bit about chilies right there. This is an older book, too. Not super old. I think it's like from 98 or something like that. 1997. Okay, back when the world was just a teensy bit more normal. Of course, I love the 90s being a 90s kid. Okay, coffee, the next item on the list of aphrodisiacs. Nothing beats a cup of Joe. It's everywhere, all the time. It probably became an aphrodisiac by default. We drink it in the morning to wake up. We drink it after dinner to close a meal. We have coffee in bed, on the couch, at the table. We mix it with cream or sugar or cream and sugar or honey or no cream, please. We ice it down when we're hot. We froth it up when we're vogue. We drink regular, decaf, imported, gourmet, flavored, blended. We use instant granules for speed, percolators for the rich taste, and a programmable drip for a Monday morning alarm. Whether in fine china or a mug, a demi-tasse or a tall Italian glass, coffee is an aphrodisiac we use daily. Who knows why anyone first believed the coffee bean enhanced love? Maybe it's the dark, rich color of the freshly brewed pot, or its pleasing, bitter scent wafting through the air, or the jolt of caffeine pumps through our blood. Or maybe it's just because you offer someone coffee, you are welcoming them to sit down and stay a while, and friendliness is always attractive. And of course, too much of these things will not be a good thing. Obviously, like too much coffee can make you feel really rigid and really anxious, so that's obviously not a good thing. Always the balance thing. Remember, Zog is always promoting extremes all the time. So you always have to take everything into context and make it be balanced. Something else that's good is basil, something I like quite a bit. I just like kind of just sometimes shredding the fresh leaves over like soup, over like some chicken stock soup. I just like to have it that way. Considered the royal herb of the Greeks and the sacred herb in India, the alluring power of basil has been used for centuries to keep wandering eyes focused homeward. Early on, says Vera Lee in Secrets of Venus, wives and with straying husbands powdered their breasts with pulverized basil. Haitian lore claims basil comes from Urzuli, their goddess of love. And today, some therapists use the essential oil of basil to treat the Madonna whore complex. That's interesting. But it's more than its history or essential oil that makes basil an aphrodisiac. It's the beauty of a healthy basil plant with its buttery leaves painting a background of green for the white flowers. Once picked, its fragrant scent seasons a plain strand of pasta, adds a third dimension to a simple garden salad, and makes a frozen pizza almost edible. Celebrate basil. Make a laurel of purple and green leaves dotted in basil flowers. Don flowing white clothes. Run through a field of flowers and tumble into the ground with your partner, kissing until you can no longer. A little bit about basil right there. And that's a fun ingredient to use in a lot of different things year-round. I always liked it. I always like the softer herbs better. And grapes. A little bit about grapes. Considered to be one of the first fruits, these luscious spheres we know as grapes produce many things fine and good. Try to imagine a world without grapes. Certainly, some substitutions will work. No more home-canned muscadine jelly for your buttermilk biscuits? Try strawberry jam. No more rich juice to sip? Apple will suffice. No more pale green, ruby red, or midnight purple clusters for the artist's still life? Pears are pretty. No more grape vine to swirl about your fresh-cut flowers? How about some wheat stalks or ferns? No more Chardonnay or Beaujolais or Pinot Noir or Port or Champagne or Sherry or Vermouth? That's okay, you can still distill some elderberries in your backyard. No more plump bites of juice and sweet that squirt a fountain of aphrodisial power and grape flavor into your mouth? That's right, no more. Oh, to shudder at the thought of such a sad existence. Savor your grapes and appreciate them. So there's so many ways to have grapes. Not a favorite fruit of mine, just okay. I prefer like the stone fruits. I like a lot of tropical fruits actually, like passion fruit and stuff like that. Those are some of my favorites. The next thing in here would be strawberries, something that is typically associated with Valentine's Day, but they always give you these humongous strawberries that typically don't really taste oh so good. It looks really good. And strawberries really aren't peak. Strawberries are really gonna like be peak around April, May, pretty much. Yeah, like April, I would say. Yeah. So here's a bit about strawberries. And sometimes I'll keep these in the freezer. Of course, you know, you get them fresh, they're gonna be from somewhere else in the world. I guess that's one of the pros of all this globalism, right? Is getting all these exotic fruits and such like that. I guess it would just be nicer just to live in a tropical area and have all those exotic fruits. But yeah, strawberries are something that are nice, and they're usually associated with Valentine's Day, even though they're not necessarily in season right now. In the words of one friend, "Le hommage que tu m'envoies en goût ma goût pour le froid," which translates as, "The picture you sent me has raised my taste for strawberries." These fruits, rivaled only by the smooth cherry in innate sensuality, come as the harbinger of summertime. In the wild, the mix of tart and sweet red berries dot the landscape, swirling and twirling, a thicket of glory. In the store, they come packed by the carton, shoppers peering carefully through each cellophane wrapper in hopes of finding the perfect red ultimate strawberry. Not a bad choice for an evening of seduction. The strawberry has a green button top that fits easily betwixt the fingers. And you can feed those to chickens, by the way, like the green top. And more importantly, a berry that fits even more easily betwixt parted lips. Imagine for just one moment your partner as a strawberry lightly dusted with confectionery sugar or dipped in chocolate. Or just enjoy your lover as most often the strawberries do, plain as its essence, beautifully ripe. The strawberries are pretty good, although not my favorite berry. Favorite berry, actually, no, maybe it is. I think, yeah, I always think cherries are berries, but they're actually stone fruits. Honey, another interesting and good food. Always nice to have some honey in the house, especially one that's local to your area. That's always nice to have, and it's always good to get one that is raw. And oftentimes it will say unheated. I think it's better to look for unheated on the label than just raw. So that's something to think about. And if you get honeycomb, that will always be raw because that's just the honey on the comb. And that's really great stuff to have, honeycomb. Very nice flavor. You can just spit out the wax when you're done eating it. So here's a bit about honey. From the Kama Sutra to the perfumed garden to the Bible, honey has been connected with love, sex, and sensuality extraordinaire since the beginning of time. In the 5th century BC, Hippocrates prescribed it for sexual vigor. Tradition in India offers a bridegroom honey on his wedding day. Newlyweds typically go on a honeymoon, a practice that stems from an ancient tradition of couples going into seclusion and drinking a honey concoction until the first new moon of their marriage. In fact, Attila the Hun drank himself to death with honey on his honeymoon. Physiologically, honey provides the very usable form of sugar that converts easily into energy. Psychologically, honey encompasses sensuality. The very word honey conjures up golden images of drippy, sticky, viscous substance of honeybees, of honeysuckle, of all things sweet. And why shouldn't it? It comes from the nectar of flowers, from orange blossoms and dandelions, from raspberries and clover, from springtime and buzzing bees. Taste and enjoy. Great stuff. A bunch of recipes using honey follow. Another thing is artichokes. This is a very interesting vegetable. It's in the thistle family, artichokes. Tough green leaves, each armed with its own thorn, stand on guard. They rally their strength to make one tightly woven bud, protecting the exquisite beauty found inside their walls. This aphrodisiac, like many lovers, plays hard to get, which, like many suitors, just makes one want it more. Fortunately, some very hungry body figured out how to unleash the velvety softness found in the stubborn artichoke. Experience it for yourself. And they're saying that insert your thumb at the very center of a blanched artichoke where the leaves meet. Slowly pull the petals apart and down. As the leaves fold down, they will reveal a veritable painting of green, white, and purple. Don't stop there, but delve deeper to the center. Continue until you spy the yellow-white fur. And then you basically pick out that fur, and then you will find the heart of the artichoke. It's like there's so much of it that's like kind of just waste unless you're actually chewing on the leaves or getting the meat from the leaves. And then you find the fur, and then you can eat the inside of the heart inside of it. Interesting food. They make wine sometimes taste really weird, artichokes. Not so much beer or other drinks, but if you're going to be having like a really nice wine with dinner, you probably wouldn't want to serve artichokes because it would just mess it up. It just would be a waste, essentially. And another one in here. Let's see. Moving right along. Oysters, something I talk about on the broadcast here and there. I did a post last week on Telegram talking about the benefits of zinc in oysters. They are an excellent source of zinc. I actually had some oysters yesterday. I hadn't had fresh oysters in a long time, so I had gotten myself some. I've been doing a lot of other seafoods, though, as of late. I've been liking, like, shrimp and what else? Scallops. I really like scallops a lot, and also mussels. So I've been eating that more than I have oysters, but I had oysters yesterday. Probably one of the most well-known aphrodisiac foods. I'd say probably oysters and chocolate. If somebody asked me what I thought when I think of aphrodisiac food, I probably would say oysters and chocolate. So perhaps the greatest of all aphrodisiacs, the oyster symbolizes virility and passion for all who indulge. From Petronius to Casanova, oysters have unleashed their powers of seduction on unwitting prey and restored life to lagging libidos. The oyster's powers are best experienced when eaten on the half shell. In this state, the oyster is most reminiscent of key body parts, officially qualifying as an aphrodisiac. Some see the closed shell as the male testes, while others see the fresh oyster itself as a better representation. But few can debate the beauty or implications of the oyster resting in its half shell, neither petals of pink and gray fluttering out from the meat onto a pearly white backdrop. If the sheer visual effects of the oyster do not suffice, then consider the oyster's nutritional benefits to the human body. They are high in protein as well as loaded with zinc, a key ingredient to testosterone production and hence sexual performance for both sexes. And also zinc is powerful for immunity. It's really, really good stuff. I really like oysters quite a bit. I think they're probably one of my faves. I usually like to have them raw, but if you don't want to do them raw, you can do oysters Rockefeller, which is like a cooked dish. It was a very popular dish, I think about like 100 years ago. It's got spinach, which I'm not a big fan of. I might even just do them with like parsley or maybe like dandelion greens or maybe even like a little bit of like kale if I was to make them, you know? But yeah, anyway, that's an idea for cooked oysters right there. And rosemary. Here is another food that's considered an aphrodisiac. Rosemary is something I think smells very good, but I think I've grown to comprehend that I like the smell better than I like it in food. I'd rather use like basil or cilantro or parsley, like those softer herbs in food, than the woodier herbs like the rosemary and the oregano and the marjoram and the thyme. Rosemary, unmistakable. The scent of rosemary fills a room, consumes the olfactory.
Whether growing in sunlit window planter, flavoring olive oil and hot country bread, or scenting the soft curve of a woman's neck, rosemary entices the sense of smell. Madame de Sévigné found rosemary intoxicating. Medieval women scented the bath water with it to allure men. Perfumeries have incorporated its captivating scent into many a perfume formula. Apparently, it plays on humans' keen scent memory, our strongest tie to most emotional experiences, according to Cynthia Watson in Love Potions. In theory, if the scent of rosemary is present during a particularly amorous event, future hints of rosemary's heady bouquet will hearken one's lover back into the pleasing affair. If executed properly, one may eventually evoke a Pavlovian, quote, call to love with a mere waft of it in the air. But rosemary's charm does not stop with its fragrance. One should not ignore its tactile aphrodisiac properties. The soft needles on a sprig of rosemary tickle every nerve ending they brush past. All to say, rosemary is one very potent herb. And yes, it is. And it's a nice looking herb too. It's just nice sometimes to have it around the house. And the next one on here after rosemary would be edible flowers, something you don't see that often. Of course, you can grow your own edible flowers if you were so inclined. And sometimes I will see, I guess, like what you call like a spring mix or a salad mix at the store, and they will have edible flowers in the spring mix. But these do not last very long at all. They're really pretty. Sometimes pastry chefs will take them and they will candy them, actually, and like put them on a cake. It's really pretty. Edible flowers, nasturtiums, fuchsias, lilies, hibiscus, rose, orange blossoms, jasmine, chrysanthemums, gladius orchids, pansies, lilacs, apple, borage, lavender, lemon, viola, marigolds, geraniums, daisies, squash, blossoms, mimosas, violets, and chamomile. Flowers are the plant's sex organs, and they evoke the sex-drenched, bud-breaking free-for-all of spring and summer. An explanation of the aphrodisiacal powers of flowers as only Diane Ackerman can say it, A Natural History of Love. Lore has had it that the sweet juice of the honeysuckle induces erotic dreams. Plucked off one by one, daisy petals tell whether he loves me, he loves me not. A dandelion with one swift puff of air tells of a lover's faithfulness or lack thereof to a relationship. Flowers speak when people cannot. The red velvet rose of love, the virgin white rose of purity, the unopened buds of innocence. A suitable variation exists for every conceivable situation, and from the carefree wildness of violets and hibiscus to the exquisite architecture of a single orchid, flowers run the gamut for the emotional mind and palate. Add them to your vocabulary. So a little bit there about flowers, a very interesting thing to be eating. You can also, if you've ever grown zucchini before, you'll know that zucchinis typically have that that little blossom or flower attached to it. You can actually take those and you can cook with them. Some people just actually dip them in batter and cook them as is. I would use, obviously, like refined coconut oil for doing that, a saturated fat, of course. And some people will take them and they will take a pastry bag that they fill with like ricotta cheese and they'll pump that into the squash blossom and then they'll either put that in a batter or just as is and then they'll fry that off. So some interesting ideas with different things that you might just have out there. You could have stuff in your yard or your surrounding areas that you might not even know are food, right? Especially good to think about that with all these manufactured Zog food shortages, right? So another food on the aphrodisiac list is avocado. Once again, the doctrine of signatures is working in full force here. The modest avocado, with its bumpy, often lizard-like skin, peels away to reveal a creamy, natural butter. Cut in half, the pear-shaped symmetry of the avocado mimics the soft, buttery curves of a woman. A striking green that earned its own name in a box of crayons. The meat of the avocado gives under the pressure of a finger and melts on the tongue in a taste all its own. And yes, it's a very interesting taste, avocados. People who don't like them have said that they taste like soap. I don't feel that to be true, but anyway, everyone has their own feeling on this. And of course, they've made it very trendy, the avocado, as of late. I feel like some people didn't even know what an avocado was like 5 years ago. It's kind of weird.
In the Aztec culture, avocados were called acuatl, testicle, and deemed so powerful that, as Cynthia Watson states, they forbade village maidens to set one virginal toe outside the house while the fruit was being gathered. Today, avocados run the gamut of dishes and cuisines, and more importantly, virgins now have access to the forbidden fruit. The avocado, it's not just for guacamole anymore. And if, yes, it is a fruit. Oftentimes we think of it because we use it in more of a vegetable connotation, but botanically it's a fruit, just like eggplant is a fruit. So are all melons, that would be like cucumbers and the summer squashes and stuff like that. Tomato is a fruit. Bell peppers are fruits. Chiles are fruits. So all these things are fruits, even though we think of them as vegetables. And oftentimes these, quote, fruit vegetables tend to have less anti-nutrients than the vegetables. So it's just something to keep in mind. You know, don't have to obsess about anti-nutrients like they want you to, but just something to keep in mind when it comes to what you choose to eat and how it works for you. Okay, a little bit there about avocados. And then something here, a little bit about libations. That's the idea of having a cocktail. Of course, just like too much coffee, too much alcohol could also kind of dull or dampen the mood, where one or two or three of something, but then if it gets to a higher point, it can just go in the opposite direction. So there's always the context and there's always the balance. Behold how Bacchus, the aider and abettor of Venus, doth offer himself. And let us therefore drink up this wine, that we may do utterly away with the cowardice of shame and get us the courage of pleasure. Apuleius, the golden ass, as quoted in The Secret of Venus. Alcohol has served throughout history as a basis for most love potions, masking the foul taste of bizarre ingredients. Today, fortunately, we typically rely on alcohol not for its hocus-pocus concoctions of wormwood and such, but for its innate aphrodisiacal powers alone. After a mere drink or two, it lowers inhibitions and allows people to do what they only fantasized about a possibility just 1 hour before. Whether sipping margaritas on the beach, savoring a glass of Merlot with some Camembert, or shooting body shots in the game of quarters, alcohol pushes aside the doubts, fears, and more that typically restrain people from amorous pursuits. It transforms the could-have-beens into really, well, at least for one night. So again, I guess it really depends on the person and what you choose to do, but I guess they can, in certain contexts, be an aphrodisiac, but like I said, too many will go in the opposite direction. That's true of a lot of stuff. You know, it's always finding that balance and not falling into the Zog extremes, right? Another food, finally, which I guess also is a very aphrodisiac food when I think of it, would be figs, right? Even kind of has a look that very much resembles, I guess you'd say, testicles to an extent. If you've never had a fig before, it will not and cannot taste, smell, look, or feel as you imagined it would. Because a ripe fig tastes sweeter than any dried nugget of trail mix fig, and a plump one smells gentler than any hyper-syruped canned version. A small pear-shaped delicacy, its skin ranges from a soft white to a purpley black, its flesh from a yellow pink to a vibrant pinkish red. And the feel. A knife slices through the fruit like soft butter. The tiny edible seeds seem unending, weaving layer upon layer of texture and flavor within the succulent fig. All ridges work inward to a core, painting a relief portrait of the soft world of inner thighs. When you eat a fig, you are tasting history, Cleopatra, Dionysian orgies, the Roman Saturnalia. And when its juices run over your tongue, you are drinking pure, unadulterated sensuality. Well, it is a book that's, I guess, a romance book, so that's why they're using this romantic language, this sensual language. But yeah, figs are really good. I like them sometimes just with a bit of cheese, actually. That's a really good snack right there. Easy snack. And there's something that you can grow yourself. Joss is saying, been wanting to plant for trees. Yeah, you got to keep the birds away from them, though. The birds will be munching them. But yeah, figs are great. When they're dry, they don't really taste nearly as good. I don't think, anyway. I'm not a big dried fruit fan in general. I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I'll use it like a little bit, like if I'm baking something, but not super into dried fruit. I'd rather use fresh or frozen fruit. And of course, some canned fruit could be good to have in a pinch, just in case. Like when I talked a couple of weeks back on a show, I talked about good things to stock up on. It could be good to have just some canned fruit, you know, hopefully something that wasn't canned using any gross ingredients, you know, things like that, like nothing with like citric acid, natural flavors, etc. But that could be like a good food just to have for, you know, just in case, like a good like shelf stable food right there. Okay, so just a little bit more from this book right here that is talking about food in the aphrodisiac context. So here is a little bit about what food or what type of food would be the best food to give each of the zodiac signs, like if you were looking to romance them, I guess, right? So for Aries, keep the hyperactive ram occupied with a dozen raw oysters to shuck. Gemini. The twins are, I think it's not even going, I think it's, is it going? Oh, it's going alphabetically. Okay, I was like, which way is this going? Okay, so Aries, I'll start with Aries and Aquarius. Aquarius, to keep your independent Aquarius a bit closer to home, prepare a richly colored platter of honey-drenched figs. So Aries gets the oysters, Aquarius gets the honey-drenched figs. Cancer, nurture your deserving crab into bliss with a lemon honey spritzer. So like a little beverage. Capricorn, sure, goats will eat anything, but for real aphrodisiac power, serve your Capricorn a cup of classic tomato basil soup. Gemini, the twins are always hungry for a change, so take your lover on an adventurous culinary tour with strawberry pasta. Sounds interesting. I've never had any of those fruit pastas before, but I've heard of them. Leo, make your lion roar with a sweet frittata with flowers using marigolds you grew yourself. Libra, draw straight from the Libra's strawberry garden and prepare a chocolate cake dressed in berries. Pisces, transport your fish to a tropical island home with a pineapple boat of Jamaican fruit salsa. And that sounds actually really good. I like fruit salsas. It's actually really good with fish. Believe it or not, like a nice, lean, low-fat, white fish would be great with like a fruit salsa. Sagittarius, keep your vivacious archer aimed at you with French toast baked in honey pecan sauce. Scorpio, avoid mediocrity for your Scorpio's high standards by serving grilled scallops with basil and lavender essence. Taurus, this is my sign, satisfy your great gourmand in your life with a champagne tureen. And a tureen sometimes can have a multitude of connotations in regards to whether being sweet or savory. This one is a sweet one, but oftentimes pâté isn't a tureen, like those old school meat dishes that use like organs and all the wiggly bits, all the good stuff. So champagne tureen is made with gelatin. So it's one of those gelatin desserts. It's one of those gelatin desserts, but it actually has champagne and Grand Marnier in it. And speaking of gelatin, I made this really cool Jell-O mold and actually posted it on, I think it was Telegram yesterday. It was like three layers, like a Jell-O ring. You know, back in the day when people used to live in high trust white neighborhoods, you'd walk over to a neighbor's house and say, welcome to the neighborhood, and give them a Jell-O mold. You know, now with the way AI and all the multiracialism, I mean, I don't know who would be, who would really be doing that anymore, who would be inclined to do such, and the reaction you would get if you were inclined to do such. It's kind of a, probably wouldn't be a good look overall, right? But anyway, yeah, Jell-O and gelatin, great stuff. I just made this mold earlier in the week. It was three layers. It was like a Jell-O ring. It was raspberry, passion fruit, and strawberry. So I had to make three different Jell-Os and then just gel one, chill it, pour over again. And then I got this really cool ring of Jell-O. But yeah, what a great food Jell-O is. And not the crud in the store. Stay away from that stuff. Make it yourself. It's pretty simple. All you need is just a couple of ingredients. I just used frozen fruit that I had pureed and taken the seeds out of. And then I just used like gelatin, water, lemon, vanilla extract, and fructose powder. Like that's it. Simple. And finally, in regards to the zodiac signs and what's a good meal for them, Virgo, the last sign alphabetically. Asparagus prosciutto rolls will appeal to your culturally minded, wholesome eating Virgo. So a little bit there about zodiac and maybe romancing someone. If you are romancing someone this Valentine's Day, if you're not, that's okay too, right? I mean, like I said in the beginning of the show, sometimes this holiday gets all caught up in the mix with it just being a romantic holiday, but think about it as a way to love your family, to love your race, to love yourself, right? To love nature, to love flora and fauna, right? Think about it in that way too, as opposed to just the connotation they give it in the media. And I mean, the media connotation of a V-Day is pretty low vibe. When you think about it, I think it puts a lot of pressure on men to do all this stuff. And if they don't, they're horrible and they don't care. But that's what they promote in the media anyway. They promote that antagonistic relationship where a woman demands all these ridiculous pieces of accoutrement for a holiday. And then if she doesn't get it, then she behaves in a certain way. Like, that's completely manufactured. It's completely and totally lame. Super lame, actually. So yeah, I don't think anyone's going to be falling into those traps. But if you are celebrating, celebrate however it makes you feel good, right? Just do whatever works for you. Make some great food at home, like you typically would most other nights, I guess, if you do that type of stuff. And just stick to that. That's what I'm going to be pretty much doing, enjoying the whole weekend and cooking and just spending time with other people, enjoying life. Even if this world is a shit sandwich right now, and it does feel like that in a lot of ways, it doesn't mean that we have to really change what we're doing. We can put our energies into things in different ways, right? And we can put our energies into ourselves and still be very aware of what's going on, 100%. But there comes a time when we have to get off of like feeding the Skeksis, right? Feeding that machine. And wouldn't it be nice if we had more things in our life that were related to magnetism, harmony, flow, trust, time for ourselves, and abundance in general, right? These are none of the things that the Oive Skeksis shitstem promotes. They promote none of those things ever. They may say that they do through some of the New Ager or the Jew Ager stuff. They don't promote a stitch of any of these things. What do they promote? They promote hustling all the time, depletion, stress, scarcity, pleasing people, and disconnection, right? And all this stuff over time really gets you nowhere. All of this rat race, Oive hustle, where does it get you? Where does it get you? More ingrained and more tethered to the Oive shitstem. That's really what it does. And doing stuff that makes you feel real, that is real, is more important now, I think, than ever before, right? Than ever before. So that's what I guess I will leave everyone with for this little kind of mini holiday special edition of White Wellness. And I will say this also before I go too, that this is a long time game, this thing, this whole spiritual war. This isn't just like something that's, I think, going to be resolved, I think, with our generation. This is not to be blackpilling or anything like that. This is just, this is a long haul. And to be in the long haul like this, it's really important not to get caught up in a lot of their emotive snares or their emotional snares. Otherwise, you're just being used by the culture in a certain way. And then that also kind of takes you away from your racial identity, I think, in a certain way, because when it really comes down to it, all a racialist is a white person who's connected to nature. That's it. They may tell you many different things in the Zio media, but that's all crud. That's all a lie. That's all based on their seething hate and their vitriol for the natural world, right? So if you get too caught up in these snares, you end up being used by the culture, and that takes you away from nature and actually makes you less of a racialist. That's not what you want. You don't want your reaction to be a mirror to what you take in, right? Or you do, actually, but you want it to be a mirror to what you take in. If it's positive, if it's negative, then you're just being used by the culture. And that's not good, especially now when we're on a precipice. Even though it's a long game, we're still very much on a precipice. So I'll leave everyone with that for this week's or this day's, however you see it. I think I did two shows this week, right? I did. We'll say this week's edition of White Wellness with me, your host, Tabitha. That was easy listening for you. Look, a little holiday show right there. And I hope everyone has an awesome weekend, whatever you do, whether you're engaged in a romance for Valentine's Day, or you're loving yourself or your race, your family, your pets, your children, whatever it may be. That's what we should be focused on. That's what the focus should be. That's always where it really starts, is how Mike has been saying on one of his last broadcasts, to save yourself. Yeah, always be willing to share the message with other humans. That's a fabulous thing, but pull yourself away from supporting this Skeksis. Starve it. It's been starving you your whole life, so now it's time to starve it. So I'll leave everyone with that. Be sure to catch all the wonderful broadcast over here at the one and only American National Radio Network. Wishing everyone a groovy Friday and a groovy Valentine's Day weekend. White blessings and white love to all. Sat Nam. Okay. Goodbye, everybody.